culminating in 586 at the hands of the Babylonians, the kingdom of Judah in the south was taken captive. But a God who knows all, a God who sees how things will play out, can also say, here is what's going to happen later on. Deuteronomy, the 30th chapter, now, and beginning in verse 1. So it shall be, when all these things have come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind in all nations where the Lord your God has banished you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey Him with all your heart and soul according to all that I command you today, you and your sons, then the Lord your God will restore you from captivity and have compassion on you and will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. God said, you'll be torn out of the land when you depart from me. But when you remember me, I'll restore you again. Of course, that would occur under the reign of the Persians. But it's not just when we come to the book of Daniel that we read that the Persians were going to be the ones who allowed God's people to return. Who remembers what other Old Testament prophet, even a couple of hundred years before the fact, had predicted this event? Anybody? Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 44, beginning in verse 28 and going through the first verse of chapter 45. The Lord declares through Isaiah, it is I who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he'll perform all my desire. And he declares of Jerusalem, she will be built, and of the temple your foundation will be laid. Thus says the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed, whom I have taken by the right hand to subdue nations before him and to loose the loins of kings, to open doors before him so that gates will not be shut. Okay. When Isaiah writes this, Assyria is still the dominant world power. Babylon has not even reached its height. So God is looking ahead of time. Let's look just a little bit about how this came about. This is a map of the ancient Near East. Of course, right over here is Palestine. We talked about this on Monday. You've got these two significant rivers of Mesopotamia, the Tigris and Euphrates, which is where what modern nation is? Iraq. Okay, so when you think of Iraq in the news, it's right here. Saudi Arabia is here. So all this is happening in this area of modern-day Iraq. Again, now Babylon is the world power. What happens, though, is that there's this kingdom of the Medes to their north. Cyrus was not a Mede, he was a Persian. And he was a noble in a somewhat relatively obscure area of Persia. But he came to power. And he gathered his forces and became stronger and stronger until ultimately he was even able to achieve victory first over the Medes themselves at Ecbatana in 550 B.C. And the reason why we refer to this not just as the Persian kingdom but as the Medo-Persian kingdom is because his policy was not of oppression, not of just complete subjugation, but of actually bringing other peoples in and making them, co-regents almost. You know, they were a part of his kingdom. It's not just now the Persian kingdom, it's the Medo-Persian kingdom. And so these combined forces, they continue to march, they rid their foes in Lydia at Sardis in 546, and then after the death of Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon had entered into a period of decline. So in 536 or 539 on this map, Babylon is defeated. And of course, there's a chapter in Daniel that has something to say about this as well, and that's in Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar, who is ruling in Babylon, his father was actually the king, but his father had been away from Babylon for some time. Belshazzar is ruling there, and you even read, and of course, here's where this vision of this hand coming and writing the Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. You've been weighed, measured, and balanced, and found lacking, and the Lord was bringing judgment on them. And so it says in verse 30 of chapter 5, that night Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain, so Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. Here is the transition from Babylonian power to the power of the Persians and the Medes. So that's how we come to Daniel chapter 6. We'll talk about this chapter here in just a little bit. Just not that we need to spend a whole lot of time on this. There are questions about who this Darius is. Darius is the power. He's the one in authority in chapter 6. Now, there's certainly going to be a famous Persian king by the name of Darius. But he's not for some time after this. And it would not seem, even in reading Daniel chapter 6, because Daniel mentions Cyrus at the end of chapter 6, it would not seem that Daniel's confused this. So what that leads us to believe anyway is, remember, Persia is a vast empire. Persia would have been divided into all kinds of smaller kingdoms, and there was a smaller kingdom there in Babylon. And so Darius is a name, maybe not the only name given, but it would seem that Darius is a name that's given for the man who was ruling there in Babylon over that area. And that's how Daniel figures in to what's happening here. All right, that's enough intro, historical background. I really like that stuff. Hopefully it does something for you as well. Any questions on any of that, though? All right, let's start in the text then. The text begins by noting the continued success of Daniel. And of course, that is a theme that began in chapter 1, as we noted that as God had given Israel over into the hands of Babylon, God had also given favor to Daniel. God had given knowledge and wisdom to Daniel and his friends. And because of that, Daniel and his friends had risen to prominence in the kingdom of Babylon. Well, that continues as Daniel is now under the yoke of the Medes and the Persians. So it seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, and they would be in charge of the whole kingdom. And over them, three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, so the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to anoint him or appoint him over the entire kingdom. So again, here is Daniel. He continues in this great success. It may have been that he was originally one of the 120, but quickly he became one of three who was an authority over all 120. But now, rapidly, he's about to be promoted to being the chief over all of them, only answerable probably to Darius himself. Well, that certainly would stoke some jealousy from others. So the other commissioners, it would seem these other two would have been the prominent ones with some of the satraps. They decided, we've got to do something to stop this. I don't know what all it was about Daniel that they disliked. Maybe they were taking things on the side. Maybe they were dishonest and Daniel was not playing that game, because it says that the king suffered no loss at the hands of Daniel. Daniel had been faithful in every charge that the king had given him. And so even as they're looking for things to make a complaint about Daniel, to lead to Daniel's downfall, there is nothing that can be found. Except for one thing in their minds, and what is that? His God. Okay. The Persian king was God. If you ever read any of your ancient Greek historians, not that most of us spend late night hours just perusing Herodotus, that's exactly what you get when you read about these ancient Persian kings. They were gods on earth. I don't know if Cyrus quite viewed himself that way as his those who followed him did, but when you are in charge of an empire, and now as Darius here is in charge of this kingdom, these figures not only exercise political rule, they exercise religious authority. The king was the God. And so, These other commissioners and these other satraps, they look and they say, Daniel is not playing by these rules. He worships a foreign god. And remember those who were on Monday. What was the whole point of when Nebuchadnezzar had had victory in Jerusalem and he brings back to Babylon the articles from the temple? Where does he place those articles? Anybody remember that from Daniel chapter 1? Yeah, in the house of his God. What's that supposed to symbolize? My God defeated your God. That's the point. Nebuchadnezzar's God had defeated the God of Daniel and of the Jews. And the Persians would have thought of these things in much the same way. We are the victors. We are the conquerors. Therefore, your gods, if they exist, are not quite like us. They're not as powerful as us, or else you would not be subject to us. Well, that's the only complaint they can find against him. And I'm kind of skipping ahead here. So they all come to the king with this matter. Now, they don't say that, hey, we found something on Daniel we want you to take care of. Rather, they appeal to his ego. Say, hey, oh, great king, we propose that for a period of 30 days, no one worship or bow down to any other god or pray to any other god except for you. And again, for someone who's in a position not just of political authority, but also of religious authority, would have played well to the ears of Darius. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. This would probably even unify the kingdom some, bring us all under this common religion. So sure, we'll make the decree. And there's something that's mentioned here several times. It's mentioned so many times, now I can't find. So for instance, in verse 8. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. That's going to play a large role in this story. The same thing you'll find in the book of Esther. When the king there gives a decree about the destruction of the Jews, well, he cannot just revoke that decree. He has to issue another decree. And this is something that's also found in secular records. So it's something that actually validates the testimony of Daniel and of Esther. That when the Persian king made a decree, it was law and it could not be revoked. I don't know why that is. I haven't read a great explanation of why that is. Perhaps it had to do with that religious authority again. If this is the mouth of God saying something, then God's not going to change his mind. I don't know for sure. Steve, did you have anything on that one? Okay, well, I saw you moving your lips, man. Steve had the answer for me. All right. So, this decree goes into effect. Now, you know the story from here. Daniel hears this. I think I'm probably behind. Daniel hears this, and what does he do? Just keep praying. Three times a day. Goes to where he's always prayed. Same in the same direction. That idea, by the way, of him praying towards Jerusalem, don't think that was given as a blanket statement of here's how the Jews had to pray. You had to pray facing to Jerusalem. But you remember when King Solomon established a temple, he would say things like, and when your people remember your place and they look to this place, hear them. And so that's probably the reason why Daniel would even face Jerusalem and pray towards it. Daniel keeps on praying. And his fellow commissioners, they knew he would do it. They met at an appointed time. An appointed place. They say, we meet here at this time in this place. We will catch Daniel in the act. And they caught Daniel in the act. So they come back to the king. Back in verse 12, they come back to the king. They said, did you not sign an injunction? And any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days, will be cast in the lion's den? The king replied, the statement is true. According to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. They answered and spoke before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah. You know, they did not say, Daniel, our fellow commissioner, Daniel in whom you've never found any problem, Daniel who seems to be the best of us. No, he's an exile. He's not one of us. He's from Judah. He pays no attention to you or to the injunction which you signed, but he keeps making his petition three times a day. They've got him. There's nothing the king can do. You'll note what it says in verses 14 and 15. He was deeply distressed, set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king established may be changed. We've got him. All Darius can do is hope. He cannot intervene. And so he says things to Daniel like in verse 16, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. And Daniel is cast in the lion's den, and they seal it with the king's ring. You'll note an interesting thing. The king went off to his palace and spent the night, verse 18, fasting with no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. It's possible Daniel had a better night's rest that night than King Darius did. He can't do anything. He knows Daniel's not guilty of anything, but he's worshipped his God. He's violated this law that he made. Now, this is one of those ideas in Hebrew, in Old Testament scriptures that I don't fully understand, but one of those chiasms, I think they call it. Again, I'm not educated in these things. But it's one of those interesting things when you see a story progress and then you see the other part come right back. And that's what you see here in Daniel chapter 6. Darius was hoping for deliverance. Now Darius sees deliverance. The king rose at dawn at the break of day, verse 19, and went in haste to the lion's den. When he came near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. And also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. And the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him because he had trusted in his God. So Darius hoped for deliverance. He can't do anything about it. But he sees that God has in fact delivered Daniel. Daniel's colleagues had planned for the death of Daniel. Daniel's colleagues meet their own death in verse 24. The king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. They had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Darius had already signed a law which could not be revoked. Now Darius signs a decree. Verses 25 and following, the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in all the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is a living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Again, this king cannot revoke his decree, but he in effect issues a new decree. Now you will worship the God of Daniel. And we end right as we began. Daniel, who had been so successful, had risen in the favor of the king. Daniel continues in this. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And I take that verse, by the way, to indicate a co-regency. Cyrus is king over all, and I believe that Darius would have been king over Babylon, if that makes sense. All right, that's the chapter. That's the story. Any questions or comments about anything in the chapter? We'll go on to make some points here in just a minute. All right. few things. I think one of the main points in this, and what we're to see from this, is how God delivers. King wanted to deliver Daniel. And think about this. Here is a man, when it comes to his kingdom, he has absolute rule, power, and authority. If anyone was going to save him, it would have been the king. King's hands are tied. Can't do it. I want to. He frets all day over it. Come sunset, his advisors come back and say, no, you can't do anything about this. You've got to throw him in. Can't sleep at night. He just can hope. Deliverance can only come from God. So as the king says, your God will himself deliver. When he comes back to the tomb the next morning, has your God been able to deliver? And then Daniel responds, my God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth. And in the case in verse 23, this is because Daniel trusted in his God. Again, the same faith that Daniel had had back 70 years ago in Daniel chapter 1, the same faith he has now. My God did this. I trusted in him. And so even in the decree of the king, he delivers, rescues, performs signs and wonders. There's a valuable lesson there for us today. Do not hope for your deliverance in anything else. Your deliverance is not dependent on the financial well-being of the markets. Your deliverance is not dependent on who is in control of the government. Your deliverance is not dependent on what is going on in the nations of the world. Your deliverance will only come from God. My deliverance will only come from God. Man can't do it. Darius, the most powerful man in his kingdom, could not do it. God can. All right. Another point, then I want to get to something and spend a little bit of time on. There's an interesting also juxtaposition of what happens when people see devotion in our lives. I don't necessarily think of Daniel as just being, you know, just out in people's faces with, hey, I serve Jehovah God. Are you serving Jehovah God? You all serve Jehovah God. Let me tell you what. He might have done that. He might have. But I do know Daniel was doing this. Daniel did not shy away from letting people know what he was doing. It was evident to all. The king knew it. The commissioners knew it. The satraps knew it. They didn't have to go in and look for things they could accuse Daniel of. When they were thinking about this, there's only one thing that came to their mind. Daniel serves this God we don't serve. And he's praying to him three times a day. We know he's doing this. We know where he's doing this. It's plain to see. Now what that means is, if our devotion is seen, it's going to be the source of derision and or persecution. Much of the world just doesn't want it. And that's what got Daniel in trouble, if you want to call it trouble. They hated him for it. I've mentioned this before. It's hard to believe, and again, I don't think of myself as being old, but it's a new ball game for kids in their teens. It's a brand new ball game from when I was a teen. Just social norms that we thought were pillars in society, they're not there anymore. And to be contrary to those social norms, because I believe in a God of the Bible, that is going to bring upon them so much more derision than I ever faced. I mean, I think of one time, it wasn't even derision. I was talking to a friend about why I didn't go to prom, and he said, you ought to watch the movie Footloose. I'm like, well, okay. Like, I don't really think that counts as persecution. That was just kind of lame. But that's not what they're going to have now. Oh, you think homosexuality is wrong? You're a bigot. You hate people. You will be derided if your devotion is known to God, about God. But it can help others. It can help the few come to God. I don't harbor illusions that Darius maintained his faith. That would have been wonderful. I imagine much like Nebuchadnezzar, who had been brought to his knees by Jehovah God, I imagine that Darius would have acknowledged God here, but then probably moved on in his polytheistic mind to thinking that, well, maybe Jehovah is just one other God. Probably. But Darius had a chance at least. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Darius wound up being a faithful servant of God. That would be wonderful. But the only reason he knew anything about Jehovah God is because he knew about Daniel. And he knew Daniel faithfully served, constantly served this God. And he believed that this God would save Daniel. And so again, we look in our society, we look in our world, and there's going to be so much hatred and vitriol spewed at us because of our faith in God. But there'll be a few. There'll be some who take note and want to know about this God. All right. All credit to Tommy Peeler on this one because I didn't think of it. Maybe everyone else here has. The parallels between Daniel 6 and the story of Jesus are pretty striking. And I don't think that's by accident either. All right. Here are your parallels. What are the foes moved by? They're moved by envy of Daniel. I put the passages up there, so you can write those down. I'll read some of them here. So you read about the foes of Jesus, and particularly, of course, the Pharisees in Matthew 27 and verse 18. It speaks of Pilate and how he knew that the Jews had, because of envy, delivered Jesus over to them. There are the foes who are trying to find an accusation. And again, the foes of Daniel, they are continually trying to find, there's nothing wrong in any of his doings for the king. He seems to be perfectly faithful in everything he does for the king. There's nothing missing. We can't find anything there. Well, we've got to find something. And of course, that is so prevalent in the gospel accounts. Even early on in the ministry of Jesus, Luke chapter 6 and verse 7, Jesus is entering into a synagogue. It says the scribes and the Pharisees were watching him closely to see if he healed on the Sabbath so they might find reason to accuse him. And of course, that finding of accusations will continue on, even, of course, until his trials, when they are bringing forth false witnesses who don't harmonize in anything they say, but they're just trying to find the accusation. What can we get on him? What can we find on Jesus? He's arrested at his place of prayer. Daniel, who continued to pray three times every day, he's brought forth before the king. Of course, where was Jesus crucified? Where was Jesus arrested? Garden of Gethsemane. What had Jesus been doing in that same garden? Praying all night long. Bearing his heart out to his God. Of course, brought by his foes to the ruler and is accused before them. And of course, again, in these New Testament accounts, John 18, Luke 23, it is not the Pharisees who have the power to crucify Jesus, not the Sanhedrin, but they can bring him to Pilate. And so they bring him to Pilate just as Daniel is brought to Darius, or at least the case of Daniel is brought to Darius. So Darius is the one that will sentence him to the lion's den. It is Pilate, ultimately, that will deliver Jesus over to be crucified. Did Darius want Daniel to die? Tried to find everything he could do to let him go. Couldn't. Did Pilate want to give Jesus over to the Jews? No. Tried many, many things to deliver Jesus. Just even beginning in the text in John 19. It would even seem from this account, when you read of the scourging of Jesus, that this was meant to be something that might placate the Jews. Pilate took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and put a purple robe on him, and they began to come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews," and to give him slaps on the face. Pilate came out again and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him out so you may know that I find no guilt in him." Jesus then came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." So when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out saying, "Crucify, crucify." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." Again, Jesus has just undergone this extreme torture, torment, scourged. Pilate's trying to get him off the hook. Darius stays up all night. Can't figure out anything to deliver Daniel. But the leaders, they're the ones that are constantly reminding the ruler, no, you cannot deliver him. The commissioners and the satraps, they tell Darius, oh, you signed a decree, and according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, this is unrevocable. What's the ultimate nail in the coffin? That's probably a really, really bad turn of words there for Jesus. What is it that ultimately seals the case on Jesus? That's it. All right, Pilate, we hear what you're saying. We know you don't want to do it. And, of course, the Jews knew that Pilate hated them. So here's their trump card. You're no friend of Caesar if you don't do this. Pilate knows the political calculus. He knows that, I can't afford this. I cannot afford the Jews making an uproar to Caesar again. And them going and saying that I allowed this would-be king off the hook. That is a direct confrontation to the power of Caesar. So the ruler is unable to let him go. It's a matter of the stone being rolled. Daniel has been delivered to his supposed death. You can imagine, all right, here's all these hungry lions. Throw them in, just as you see with his enemies ultimately, and they're dead before they hit the ground. They cast Daniel in, roll the stone over. This is a tomb now. This isn't just a den of lions, this is a tomb. Jesus has died on the cross. Seems that death has won. We place him in the tomb, we roll the stone over the tomb. There's no coming back from this. Seal placed on it. The king had affixed his seal to it in Daniel chapter 6. Pilate had affixed his seal to it in the gospel accounts. This is to show that this even happens by the will of the governing authorities. No one's to tamper with this. This is a done deal. It's a time of mourning. Of course, the disciples of Jesus, they mourn. They want to make proper burial preparations for Jesus and anoint him in the proper ways as a part of their mourning. The only person mourning in the story of Daniel is, of course, Darius himself. Can't sleep. Heartbroken about what's happened. What he fears might happen. He's delivered, of course. He's delivered from the den. Daniel is delivered from the den. He's delivered by his God. And of course, that is the major point of the book of Acts. Just Jesus, whom the Jews had delivered to death, God raised him as both Lord and Christ. Daniel delivered by his faith in God. Jesus delivered because of his faith in God. Both delivered because of the power of God, even though it seemed that their death was assured. And finally, enemies were destroyed because of this. The enemies of Daniel, they were cast in the lion's den themselves. We think of the enemies of Jesus, we might think of those Jewish rulers, and certainly there was a judgment on Jerusalem in AD 70. What is the enemy that was defeated? Death itself. Satan and death. Colossians 2, 14 and 15. Having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. When he disarmed the rulers and authorities, he made a public display over them, having triumphed over them through him. Jesus triumphed over his enemies, just as Daniel did. had triumphed as well. I don't think that happened by accident. I'm not. I believe that what happened in Daniel chapter 6 absolutely happened. And it's just one of those fantastic foreshadowing events of what would happen with Jesus and His cross and His resurrection. That's all I've got. Anybody have any questions or comments on any of this? They rang one bell. They're going to release them here in about 5 minutes. John?
Kind of a minor parallel. I would think you mentioned the time of mourning, but Darius couldn't sleep. We know that he was troubled. We don't know about Pilate's sleep, but we do know his wife was troubled by the dream and said, have nothing to do with that. Kind of similar.
I'm going to email Tommy Peeler about that tomorrow morning. No, that's a good point. Good point. Anything else? Yes, Stu.
I'm not sure if you covered this. Scripture doesn't make any comparison to more important, but it is very useful to make it easier to remember.
Sure.
Because a lot of times, when you study, most of us kind of grew up studying the New Testament and didn't learn as much as the Old Testament.
So yeah. Anyone that's ever taken one of Tommy Peeler's Old Testament classes is familiar with his quotation, or maybe not even had to take a class, Nathan probably knows it already. Any list of Old Testament scriptures for prophecies of the Messiah that doesn't include every passage of the Old Testament is too short of a list. And I probably didn't say that right, but it's something like that. The whole Old Testament, in some ways, is not only leading up to Jesus, it's foreshadowing all the things of Jesus. I'm not saying every verse necessarily, but it's all bringing us to that point. So yeah, you're right. Exactly. You know, it doesn't give you that. It's like, oh yeah, here, let me make this, you know, so you'll know that, you know, 500 years in the future, this is going to happen in the Messiah. But I think when we look back at it, it's like, oh yeah, that's the parallel right there. Yeah. That's a good point as well. Very well. All right. I'm going to gear up for kids, and they'll be coming in just a minute, and we'll be closing out our vacation Bible school. Thank you so much. Okay, we're going to start with this one. We've started with this one every other day. My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. The mountains are His, the valleys are His, the stars are His handiwork too. My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do for you. Boone, I think I know what your favorite song is now. That was a great job singing, buddy. Did y'all hear that? It was great. I mean, it was fantastic. Okay. The reason I chose that song to sing it every single day is because even though we've been talking about stories about Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, as is always the case, God is the hero of the story. Daniel has faith. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they all have faith. But they have faith in a God. They have a faith in a powerful, mighty God who can and does save them. So that's why we sing about Him. All right, let's sing another song about God. Mr. Josh only does this because he loves the kids. Who put the colors in the rainbow? Who put the salt into the sea? Who put the cold into the snowflake? Who made you and me? Who put the hump upon the camel? Who put the neck on the giraffe? Who put the tail upon the monkey? Who made hyenas laugh? Who made whales and snails and quails? Who made hogs and dogs and frogs? Who made bats and rats and cats? God made everything. Here's where we get our breath. Hey, what happened? Was it that bad? Was I doing it that bad? Oh, man. Oh, well. I guess we'll just not worry about that right now. If it comes up later, we'll do the second half of the song later. That's all right. Hey, I've got some great questions that your teachers have given me that I'm going to ask you to see what you learned about Daniel and his God. Now, for my 2-year-old class, who rescued them from the fire? That Piper? Who rescued them from the fire?
God.
Yes! God rescued them from the fire. That's the one we've been singing about. Our God who's so great and so mighty, who made us and loves us and rescues us. Alright, excellent job. Okay, my 3-year-old class, that's some ferocious looking lions. How many times a day did Daniel pray?
3 times!
He did pray 3 times! That's right. You know what? I'm not saying that that's the minimum number, but I think if you guys, and us adults too, if we made it a habit of at least praying 3 times a day, I see that. I'm coming back to it, okay? I'm coming back. It'd be really good for us too. Yeah, okay. Ah, yes, okay. So y'all studied about the statue today. I'm from Alabama, so I say y'all sometimes. You guys studied about the statue. What was the head made of?
Gold,
that's right. It was made of gold. Great job. Okay. Kindergarten or first grade. When King Nebuchadnezzar looked into the furnace, how many men did he see? You went first. All right, let me ask you, how many were thrown in there?
Three.
So, there was another one. Who was it? Yeah. God said that, didn't he? So God was rescuing them. Great job. Great job. Okay. Second and third grade. By the way, just so they don't get twisted over here, they won the quiet banner this morning. They were carrying it. I want to make sure you get all credit and props due to you. So there you go. Relish in it. Which king loved Daniel but threw him in the lion's den? Darius. Nebuchadnezzar's been in a lot of our stories, but Darius, or Darius, as I was saying it, was the one who threw Daniel in the lion's den. Okay, my 4th and 5th grade class. What is the most powerful kingdom? Maybe you already had your hand up before I even asked the question. I tell you, I was one day over here, it was the 2nd and 3rd grade class, and Corbin was sitting right here, and I got the first word out, and it was, phew! Man, that's all right. Bryce. Yes, God's kingdom, that eternal kingdom. Great job. All right. My teens, middle school and high school, what does the story of Daniel in the lion's den teach you about God? Great job, Taylor. Yes.
He is powerful and almighty.
Yes, he is powerful and almighty. Ty, was that a hand up? Y'all only got one thing? Well, I mean, it's a good lesson. It's a really good lesson. Anyone else? Yes.
God can save us from our
Yes, God can save us from anything if we believe in Him. Great. Yes. Oh, that's a really good one. We shouldn't hide our love for God. We kind of talked about that in here too, about letting our devotion be seen. Great. All right. Fantastic job, everybody. Guess what? There's the second part of a song up on the screen I've been reminded about several times. Who put the gold into the sunshine? Who put the sparkle in the stars? Who put the silver in the moonlight? Who ruled earth and Mars? Who put the sin into the roses? Who taught the honeybees to dance? Who put the tree inside the acorn? It surely can't be chance. Who made seas and leaves and trees? Who made snow and winds that blow? Who made streams and rivers flow? God made everything. Great job, guys. Great job. Okay. I've got one final thing to do, and then I've got an announcement to make. I know there are some classes that want this for the final night, and I'm not sure this group necessarily deserves it right now, but because they're so cute, and they really did do a good job all week, the two-year-olds are getting the quiet banner tonight. Yes, they are. Now, I'm not going to give it to you because I don't want to be jabbed in the eyes with it here in a second, but great job, and great job to all the teachers that, particularly with little ones, had to wrestle them all week. Okay, here's the announcement. VBS is hard. Not for me. What I get to do is the fun part. I get to sing songs with all the kids. That's a lot of fun. VBS is hard. The Clarks and the Schmidts put a lot of time and effort into organizing all this. Many of you don't know that. They put a lot of time and effort into this. And they have to bring a whole lot of things into consideration to get this done. It's not easy for them. VBS is hard. They did a fantastic job. And just to make you know, Tara and Sierra in particular, they did a fantastic job. Let me tell you, VBS is hard. The teachers, every teacher, and I know because my wife was one of those, they put a lot of time and effort into this. The rooms for VBS this year are spectacular. And what Miss Pam did in Canaan is amazing. So, we want you to go and see those. We want you to see what effort was put in to let these kids learn these lessons about God. Lessons they can remember because they learned them at VBS. So all those classrooms, they're going to stay that way for a few minutes after we dismiss tonight, for probably 10 to 15 before the teachers start tearing them down. VBS is hard. And the teachers did a fantastic job, and I, for one, am grateful to every last one of you. Thank you so much. Do the shepherds have anything else? All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm so glad you came. We have a lot of visitors here tonight. I think we were the only... Valrico had VBS. We had VBS. And I think that may be it for the area for most of the summer. So I'm really glad you came. And I really hope your kids learned a lot and had a really good time doing it too. All right. We're going to have one final word of prayer. And then some of us are staying for a little while. And others of us are going home. But let's stand and let's go to our great God in prayer. Okay? Our God, the one who saved Daniel, the one who saved Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, the one whom they put their faith in, we know that you are the same God, that you are still powerful, you are still mighty, and your kingdom, which no nation has ever been able to end, will in fact reign forever. We thank you, Father, for having allowed us to be a part of that kingdom because of what you did for us in your Son. And we thank you, Father, for how much love and compassion you have for us in giving us the assurance that you still save. Help us to know you, Father. Help us to love you. Help us to follow you, even as your faithful servants did. And it's in your Son's name that we pray. Amen. Amen.